Good afternoon. You're listening to Motherlands, an Asian Heritage Month special programming show on CITR 101.9 FM, brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. I'm your host, Iso. CITR 101.9 FM broadcasts from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. I hope you've all been well. As you might have guessed already, this is the last episode as Asian Heritage Month is coming to an end, and I'm sure you're all very sad to see me go, but it is what it is. Today's theme is what comes next. Pretty self-explanatory. We'll be playing a Zoom discussion between me and a few other producers, as well as a conversation between me and Rachel Lau regarding their work on Speak My Language, a podcast by Yarrow Society. Yeah, let's get started. Rachel Lau is a local audio producer and UBC student. They helped launch Speak My Language in February 2020. Speak My Language is a storytelling media arts project, and basically in groups of two, youth volunteers produced radio documentaries with Chinese seniors about trying to access healthcare here in Canada and the barriers they might face. I had the chance to speak with Rachel, who worked as the project coordinator on this project. I asked them to explain their translation choices and to reflect on what it was like working with both elders and young people in the Chinatown community. Let's take a listen. Hi, do you mind introducing yourself?
Hi, I'm Rachel Lau. I'm a queer Cantonese artist, writer, and radio storyteller. I am a media studies student at UBC. I'm also minoring in Asian Canadian and Asian migration studies. And I've been a youth organizer in Chinatown for maybe 3 or 4 years now. And I'm also the project coordinator of the Speak My Language radio doc series.
So did they come to you with like a full-fledged idea of like what the podcast would be, how it would be structured, or were you given like a lot of creative freedom with this?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was actually living in Hong Kong when they approached me about this project. And so they messaged me on Facebook. And then they said, do you want to do something related to radio and storytelling in Chinatown? And I thought to myself, oh my God, these are all the things that I care about and don't stop talking about always. So yeah, I would love to do that. And I mean, at the time when it was presented to me, the project was somewhere along the lines of, okay, we're looking at healthcare. It has to do with Chinese seniors, storytelling. It's going to be in the form of radio, and it's going to be based in Vancouver's Chinatown. So everything else in terms of how many docs that we wanted or how we would structure it, the way that we would have the translation process work, all of that developed as we went.
So I was at the opening. It was really interesting to see like how many people had gathered there for that. Jean Swanson was there, like a lot of people are there. How do you feel about having such, like garnering that sort of attention, I think, for this project?
I think ultimately that's what we wanted to do, because this project is not only the radio documentaries themselves, but they're also part of a larger advocacy campaign that Yarrow wants to embark on and is aiming to embark on in 2020, is to advocate for language accessible healthcare for Chinese seniors. And so I am glad that it garnered that kind of attention. Jenny Kwan was also there and she spoke at the beginning of the event. And I think that we want a variety of people to be listening to these docs. When we were creating them, we asked ourselves, you know, who's going to be listening to them and why should they care about this story? And so the people that were on our list or that we came up with that, you know, we think would care or would listen to them are people with decision-making power, people in health administration in the province. It's people who care about Chinatown and are just already curious about what's happening and want to learn more. And also, most importantly, I think it's also for the seniors themselves to be able to hear themselves in these radio documentaries and feel like, yeah, my story matters and someone created something with me about this, and now it's out in the world.
So when you're working with a language barrier and you're working with people speaking different languages and the stigma and associated with not speaking English perfectly, how did you kind of try and create a good tone for the podcast? Because something in a lot of media, like when I think in a lot of media we see where someone is not speaking quote unquote perfect English, it's really oftentimes made fun of and it's kind of the butt of the joke. So how did you, you know, try and work to avoid making that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there's a couple things here. And as you say, Isa, you know, people who often speak imperfect English are made fun of. But I think we also need to go further and say that specific people are made fun of when they don't speak English perfectly. I don't think we see, for example, Chinese accents the same way that we see French accents or British accents mm-hmm. or any really European accents when people speak English. I think that there's a difference there. And I think the racialized aspect is important to focus on and point out. That being said, something that Yaro is really accustomed to is thinking through language access, because so much of the services we provide are about translation. It's about how can we help seniors access the resources that they need, even though they don't speak English, or, you know, they need to go to a medical appointment and they don't speak English. And so we are accustomed to having youth volunteers that accompany them, and we arrange these appointments so that the youth volunteers can interpret on the senior's behalf and go with them to these medical appointments. So in that way, this sort of idea about language access is already embedded in the work that Yaro does. And so I think with Speak My Language, it was a continuation of that. But one of the big questions that we asked ourselves when I first started and was brought on for this project was, how are we going to make an accessible multilingual podcast radio doc series? And throughout that process, how do we make the entire process accessible? Because if we're going to talk about language access, then we need to walk the talk, right? We can't talk about language access if we're not practicing it ourselves. And so it was a couple of things. It was, okay, how do we have all the different training sessions, and then how do we involve the seniors as much as possible so they know everything that's happening and everything that's going on? And then also the other question is, how do we make these radio docs, and how are they going to be translated or not translated in order for us to reach the people that we want to reach? And so to answer those questions, we made the sessions as accessible as possible by having interpreters at every single session. So we would have simultaneous interpretation, both Cantonese and Mandarin, during each time we had training, each time we had a listening party, which was to get the feedback from the seniors about what was happening. And also, we brought on volunteers into the project that had those language skills and had those capabilities. Most of them are either first or second generation Chinese youth, but there's also somebody who's not Chinese. And so when we were pairing the teams together, we also really labored to pair the team so that at least one person on each team had the language capacity in order to be able to communicate with their senior. And then we would pair the seniors that we had in mind or wanted to participate accordingly so that they would be matched up with the youth that spoke their language. Which was a really important aspect of making this project work. And when it came to the actual radio docs themselves, that was also a really key question is, you know, how are we going to translate? What are we going to do to make this work? And so at the time, I thought to myself, oh my gosh, are we going to have Cantonese, Mandarin, and English all in one doc? Is that a little bit too much? And after several conversations with other fellow radio folks and also the team at Yaro, we decided that we would do two versions of each doc. So one would be geared towards English-speaking audiences, which would include either Cantonese or Mandarin, depending on what the senior speaks, and English. And there would be translation, yes, but it was very intentional the way that we translated it. We didn't go for voiceovers, which is very commonly seen in media, is, you know, you hear the voice of the person speaking, not English, and then they're quickly faded into the background, and then someone who speaks English talks over them. And one of the things that I really emphasized as we were going through the training and preparing to create these docs is no voiceovers. Because not only are they hard to listen to and distracting, it's actually, in my opinion, disrespectful, because you are essentially talking over the person who doesn't speak English, and you make it so that their voice doesn't matter. And so we thought about translation not just as this sort of direct thing of moving one language to another, but actually using it as an expressive tool, as something that can communicate more, something that we strategically shape and mold in order to communicate a message. And so a lot of the producers made very intentional choices around translation in terms of how much they were going to translate. Were they going to directly translate or translate ideas? Were they going to translate first and then play the clip of their seniors talking, or were they going to do it the other way around? And what's really beautiful that's come of this engagement in this English and Chinese version of the radio documentaries is that you have a sliver of a moment, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, where an English-speaking person, especially if they only speak English, can get a sliver, a glimpse of what it might be like for the Chinese seniors to not understand the language around them that they're navigating through their daily life. So a lot of the documentaries start off cold with the senior's voice, and they just talk for, you know, like 30 seconds, a minute, you know, 40 seconds. And if you only speak English, you don't know what's going on for the first bit. And you just need to sit with that discomfort. And I think that is a really important thing that the docs are doing. And so talking about the second version of the radio docs, every single one of them actually has a fully translated Chinese version of each doc. And the reason why we wanted to have that is because we wanted a version of the doc where the seniors can just listen to it all the way through. They don't need anybody to interpret for them. They don't need any translation. They can just enjoy it. And we thought that that was really important because we are witnessing that seniors are constantly barred from accessing the world around them because of language barriers. So the last thing we wanted to do was to create a final product where they couldn't listen to it. And what's interesting about having this version of the radio docs, where it's fully translated, the narration is either in Cantonese or Mandarin, and then obviously their voices are in there as well, is that the producers really had varying challenges with the translation process. And, you know, some are more fluent speakers than others, and some don't speak it at all. So each team kind of engaged in different ways of translating the doc and how they would do that. And I think in that way, the producers also experienced language barriers, and they had a glimpse of what it was like for the seniors to navigate their daily lives. And I think what's interesting too is that all the radio documentaries in Chinese are shorter because there's no translation needed. There's so many things that producers explain through the narration for context to translate what the seniors were saying, but that wasn't necessary anymore because the assumption is that you understand. And I think that is a really key reflection in thinking about, you know, when someone is in an environment or they're presented with something where it's already their context, like there's no translation needed, and that sometimes it's more effective that way, right? It's like, yeah, I don't have to explain to you what pawpaw means, because if you're a Chinese-speaking person who's listening to it, you already know what that means.
So in this process, like, how much were you working with the Chinese seniors?
Not that much, to be frank, which I'm a little bummed about, but also I'm okay with. I think the bizarre part about being in a coordination or mentorship role is often the best thing you can do is actually step back in a lot of cases. But I would be able to see the seniors at, like I was saying, the trainings that we were doing or the listening parties where we ask for their feedback and we play all the documentaries together and see what they think, because obviously we can't email them the file to ask their thoughts. So we need to have a listening party where we're all gathered together. So those were the contexts in which I was able to work with the seniors. But from a more personal level, I think that was mainly the producers who were able to do that, where they would visit the seniors in their home and meet up with them and record together and listen to their stories and build those relationships. And I think that from the audio that I hear and also seeing all of them in the same room and interacting with each other, I really do feel like they built relationships that will last beyond the project. And I think that that is probably the most important part. Yes, the radio documentaries are important and we're glad those are out in the world now, but I think it's about those intergenerational relationships that we really value at Yarrow, and I think that the seniors and youth really appreciate.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam,
Nisiaya, Anthasiaklia, Talitin, Homasque Mustail. Welcome back to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR 101.9 FM, made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. In our first episode, we talked about the Asian Heritage Month's history here in Canada, and now that it's the last episode, the final Tuesday in May, I wanted to hold a group convo with some of the producers I worked with to talk about the implications of, like, a pan-Asian identity. Do people think it's problematic? Is it necessary? Should every day be Asian Heritage Month? So I called up a few of CITR's Asian Heritage Month producers to hear what they had to say. Let's take a listen.
Okay, I've started recording, so I'm gonna ask you guys, like, let's go around and, like, introduce ourselves to each other. Just say your name and which piece you did for Motherlands, and then we're gonna get into, like, the discussion. So I'm Isa. I coordinated Motherlands. Who's next?
Oh, I'm Adeline, and I did a piece where I interviewed the people who coordinated the Interconnected Art Project for the Vancouver Asian Heritage Month.
I'm Joshua. I did the piece about my dad's childhood in Iran, his time in England as a teenager, and his time in Vancouver where he met my mother.
I'm Akshay. I did the piece about Punjabi market and looking at the past and the future of the South Asian, like, cultural hub. So,
My name is Ziwen, and I did the piece called A Family's History of Malaysia. And it basically, I did all history of, like, my family, starting, like, from when they were in China and then when they immigrated over to Malaysia. And it's sort of like how my family was, like, affected by, like, the historical events of Malaysia, sort of tracking that over time, like, through, like, family stories and, like, written records and stuff like that. So, and like, talking to my family as well.
All right, so my first question is, have any of you guys done any kind of celebrations for Asian Heritage Month before this?
Not really, personally. I think this is more of a North American thing. I don't know, because I've never actually encountered Asian Heritage Month before.
Yeah, this is literally the first time I'd ever heard of Asian Heritage Month, to be honest. And yeah, even from this project, it was the first time I'd heard of it. It's, maybe that's something to do with me, though. Maybe I just haven't been looking hard enough.
Yeah, I haven't heard of it either. So it was interesting to kind of connect more deeply with all of this. I will check out these kinds of things from now on, because I hadn't heard of that either in all my time.
Yeah, I was the same way, where, like, I've only ever encountered this in Canada. I've never, like, celebrated anything like this back home.
Well, how does everyone feel about Asian Heritage Month as a concept? Like, it's a very pan-Asian idea to celebrate a heritage month. Do you think there's merit to having an Asian Heritage Month in the first place?
I have conflicted feelings about this. Because I'm, as Isa knows, I have very strong ideas about cultures and nation states and what constitutes identities and around those lines, right? Because like, I'm Indian, but the thing about India is it's a country with hundreds of languages, hundreds of cultures. You know, the language changes if you go 100 kilometers each way, usually. So when we say we're a country, it's a very loose connection in many ways, right? And obviously the same, I mean, if you multiply that for Asia, which is, you know, 60% of the world's population, you know, where most of the world's manufacturing is and all of that, the idea of a nation identity is very weird to me because constraining a sort of almost projecting an identity onto a continent and its people doesn't sit well with me in a, I don't know whether I would say I'm Asian over any of my other signifiers. You know what I mean? But at the same time, Asia was like in the West size, the third world, the place where all the resources were, the place where capital was. And it's the place which is most pillaged and most colonized, maybe apart from the Americas, which is the new world, right? So I think there's value in celebrating where we're coming from in that where we can trace our heritage back to places that were pillaged for resources and were stripped of their identities. But I don't know whether it's as important as many, many other things around Asian Heritage Month, because the things it celebrates are often exclusively in a Western context, which, you know, right?
So I just feel like with Asianness as a concept, it, to me, it seems more like a Western construction than anything in terms of like Pan-Asianness and like just lumping like a huge continent under one sort of like label. Because like for me personally, with the way I identify myself, because like I grew up in Malaysia, I'm Malaysian, but like I'm also Chinese, because in Malaysia we are made up of like different people groups, like Malays being the majority, Indians and like Chinese people, and like a smattering of other people groups. And like, so even like within Asia, I had a hyphenated identity. So like with the Asian identity, it just seems very like nebulous and very like very different depending on where you're from in a geographic sense and like in terms of different histories. So like that's how I feel about Asianness as a as like a sort of labeling in a way.
To sort of add on to that, I don't think this is a controversial view in any sort of circumstance, but the Western construction of an Asian identity is often intrinsically linked to East Asian identities, you know, China, Korea, Japan, and all of that. So, I mean, for example, I believe Josh's identity is listed as West Asian in the Canadian census, which is a term I've never, ever heard of, right? Because it's just these labels that are thrown around. And the label of Asian, especially, is seen in East Asian context in North America. I don't know what that does to the concept of Asian Heritage Month. Personally, from what I've seen, it seems to be pretty diverse in terms of how it's being celebrated. But there is that sort of tendency in popular imagination in the media to look at the East Asian things predominantly. And that's another thing that a lot of us don't think about when it comes to Asian Heritage Month, like West Asian people exist, like Josh, you know?
Yeah, it's funny that you were talking about that because like when I was telling my parents about this project, I mean, obviously I had to tell them about it because they're my subjects. But yeah, like when I was telling them about it, they were saying like, are we Asian? Or I guess my dad was saying, am I Asian? And yeah, that, and we were saying, you know, yeah, Iran is technically in Asia. And then when you, on the Canadian census, Iran is classified as quote unquote West Asian. That's kind of funny because I've never really thought of myself as Asian before. I mean, for multiple reasons. One, because I mean, I'm only half Iranian, so I look white as hell. And also just because like Middle Eastern people aren't usually really thought of as Asian. And even though they're technically classified under the continent of Asia, it's all strange. And yeah, labels are silly. Maybe actually, one thing that I was thinking of I guess during this discussion of, I guess, the whole issue of, I mean, a pan-Asian identity and how Asia, you know, there's different groups within Asia that often don't have much in common with one another. Maybe one thing that I feel like has been kind of neat about, I guess, this project that's centered around the concept of Asian Heritage Month is in that, like, yeah, there's in many ways the concept of it is problematic, but it's all given us kind of a chance to share our stories or share stories from the community under this silly banner of a Heritage Month that has, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it, brought us all together and given us a chance to tell stories about Asian heritage. And I mean, it's certainly, yeah, problematic in a way, but it's allowed for narratives, I guess.
So basically, yeah, a lot of the stories that we do come across, like, are like the immigration stories about how we came to North America. And of course, all like that is also in Western context too, because it's what we experience here too. So that's why I thought it was really valuable to look into the interconnected projects at this time, because they did acknowledge that usually we think of, like, you know, East Asia as being like very Asian, and, like, you know, maybe the Middle East, we don't usually identify that as being Asian, even though it is part of Asia, and things like that. So they did acknowledge that we usually have that view, like, only East Asia of Asians. So they made sure to showcase, like, a variety of artists, like, from places that usually we don't think of as Asia too. So I think on that aspect, that was portrayed well. And so I guess maybe we could look at how we can incorporate more of those kinds of things, because we do get a lot of these kinds of events, like, in a Western context, since we're celebrating Asian Heritage Month here. So it is interesting to kind of look into that a bit more in the future.
Because here's the thing that I've thought of is just, I've noticed that we've grown to expand the label of Asian, because in, like, our general idea of Asia, we're really looking at East Asians, which I'm not saying is fair, but I'm just saying, like, that's how the word has been used for a long time. And so I'm wondering if there is truly, like, merit to trying to expand that label to include as many people as possible, or if we should divert our efforts and focus on being able to tell our stories regardless of what kind of heritage that is labeled under. Thoughts?
I mean, I don't want to, you know, keep going on this dead horse, but that's the problem with sort of the geographical, like, constraints of anything, right? When you celebrate something like Canada Day or, like, something like that, I could ask the same questions. What is it about this loosely defined region, this huge region of multiple people, that has to be celebrated on this one particular day? But as I said, specifically referring to Asia, I think there is a lot of value in talking about not just the immigration story in the Western context, but just the thought of how we're being viewed by the West, right? Because I mean, the Middle East, as we all know, in the Western eye is, you know, probably enemy number one, maybe enemy number two right now behind China, which is again an Asian country, right? And the varying sort of ways in which we see Asia is never truly on the same playing field as we see in the West. So the idea of celebrating that in a Western context, I think, is quite valuable, even despite all my other objections to it.
I think my concern is with when we are trying to celebrate an Asian Heritage Month, like, what does that say about the rest of the months? If we are telling all of these stories concentrated in this month, what does that mean about the rest of the months in the year and how people of color or people of Asian descent, whatever that means, are able to tell their stories and whether they're able to be given those platforms? Like, I absolutely believe that it comes from a good place, but, like, there is that conversation to be had about what's the best way to go about elevating people and, like, letting them tell their stories. Because what if you wanted to tell the story, it's convenient that it's Asian Heritage Month and we have this holistic theme of Asianness, but we should also be allowed and be given that space to talk and we should be made feel comfortable to talk about these experiences instead of waiting till Asian Heritage Month to do it, you know?
So hopefully this gives us like some kind of awareness about this so that we can tell those stories in other months. So I feel like this is kind of like, this could be a starting point. And then hopefully like people feel comfortable branching out into other months. But yeah, like right now it seems like from one point of view, it may seem like sort of static, like it's all concentrated in this month. So I guess it depends. I guess it depends how you look at it. Like on one viewpoint, it may seem like for this month, you can kind of like delve into all these stories. And then like, so that in the other months you have awareness of it. And on the other hand, some people may only hear about it in the, during this month. So yeah.
I guess I just wanted to add that like, when it comes to like Asian Heritage Month and like the concentration of like it being in one month and like the sort of like you get this like as someone who didn't exactly identify that much as an Asian beforehand because I grew up in Asia and so like I had different contexts for my identity and like there's this feeling of like performativity where like you're like performing your Asianness for like a non-Asian audience in a sense. But then it's like for me, like I have like my own upbringing, like my own identity, and that's separate apart from like how they construct Asianness in a sense. And so like it would be nice like to be able to go away from that and being able to look at our stories from the continent and like people who like have a connection to that and like in a way that's like deconstructing the Asianness and like sort of like looking at us and like how we see ourselves instead of like performing this sort of nebulous sense of like Asianness for like an for an audience that's like not part of that. So
yeah, I think when it comes to Asianness and Asian Heritage Month, there's also the idea of being a good Asian and like performing this script that you're given about like what an immigrant's life is supposed to be like or what your experience has to be like, and if you deviate that or if you're politically, you know, you're not necessarily following that neoliberal kind of ideal of, and like you're not the biggest like supporter of capitalism, like these things kind of mark you as being ungrateful almost sometimes. This label of Asianness is good for organizing, especially in solidarity, because a lot of us do, we are treated similarly, but it's also important to recognize that like we come from like very different places and backgrounds, and also how like class and gender and all of these varying dynamics play into this as well.
To that, I'd say the idea of Asians being a model minority has been a thing for the longest time, especially in North America. And that hasn't changed with, you know, the recent wave of immigration and all of that. But more than ever, like right now with what's happening with, I think Vancouver Police Department released statistics yesterday, which showed that anti-Asian hate crimes were up by, I don't know, 80%, 90%, something crazy along those lines. So the idea of Asians being a model minority was just another sort of stick with which they could beat us with, because that's just another way to classify us, to wall us off into this. Oh, we're the model minority, and you know you're here, you're above us, and these people are below us. The celebrating Asian heritage through art and culture is valuable, but not acknowledging the stratified nature of those cultural divisions means nothing. Unless we talk about these things more and more, you know. We won't. To truly represent the pan-Asian identity, you have to represent political stripes of all colors, you know. And that doesn't mean the model minority who's good at math or whatever nonsense, you know.
I wanted to talk about also like the difference between Asian as a geographical term and also and like Asian culture, and also versus like being perceived as Asian as a race. Like, what are your guys' thoughts on that?
I guess there's somewhat of a connection we feel when we go visit like a geographic region. So I guess if we grew up in a certain place and then we went back there to visit, we feel this connection. And even if we didn't, like if we knew we were originally like, you know, like our roots were there when we go to that place, it's still significant for us. So in a way, like it can be viewed as like, yeah, like kind of like we feel very interconnected with that. But I want to hear like other people's thoughts on this.
Yeah, like very frequently whenever I talk about my own background in Canada, like they obviously see me, I'm clearly East Asian. But like they always get confused whenever I talk about my nationality and being a Malaysian, because like there's always this sense that like they always think I'm just like I have to be like from a like I have to be Chinese or like I have to be like a specific sort of Asian. But then like as a person who's like identifies myself as Chinese Malaysian, like whenever like I've talked to like other Canadians or like, I've talked to like other people in like Canada, and like they kind of don't see any of that, and they're like they have this sort of sense of like in Asia it's like your ethnicity or your race is like so connected to your physical homeland or your physical like sort of location, which is not the case generally speaking in Asia, in within Asia itself as well, because like within Asia we still have like migration within Asia itself, and so we get all this like sort of like very different sort of different peoples and like in Asia, and like we're more diverse than people assume to be the case. And so that sort of like plays into like how here there's this perception of like this monolith in Asia when that's not really the case, because we all come from like very different sort of backgrounds and very different stories, and like I guess the story of like Asia is way more complicated than what other people over here perceive it to be.
There is something that I kind of wanted to add, but it was kind of in reference to something that Adeline was saying, kind of near the start of the question. Adeline was just talking about like how like I guess people from with Asian heritage, they feel like intense ties to like I guess the countries and the places that they come from in Asia. But something that I was kind of thinking is that I mean I've lived in Canada my whole life. I've never lived in Iran. And I will probably, I don't know if I would ever be able to go to Iran, just because, I mean, my dad is from a persecuted minority group there. And I mean, I guess, I don't know if he still technically has a citizenship or not, but I don't know how safe it would be for either of us to ever go there. And in an element, a part of me kind of feels sad about that, because I mean, it's a place that I have heritage from and that I guess family from, and even just like it's also where my dad grew up, and so I feel like it would be a place that I would love to see and experience, but I don't know if it would ever be safe for me to do that, and I don't know, it's kind of sad.
I would say the racialization of Asianness is again very much a Western sort of putting things in boxes sort of thing. I don't know if you people are aware of this, but the various categories, like West Asian, whatever, like all of those categories in the census and the idea of a census itself was often used in colonized countries to create, not divisions where there were none before, but to solidify divisions where there were none before. And as we all know, like half the borders in Asia and like Africa were like drawn by white people with like a scale. The splitting up of cultures and the racialization of them differently in the Western eye often just has so much more history than I can begin to describe. But I don't know. I don't think there's value in putting racialization above culture.
Yeah, I just want to add on to what Akshay has said about like colonization, like these sort of like, because like in Malaysia, like we have the three different races, and like with like, when the British were like colonizing Malaysia, they like purposefully sort of divided up the different people groups in a sort of division of labor and a sort of like colonized the racial economy, social economy. And that like sort of that has definitely had an impact, a severe impact on like how Malaysia like construct race and ethnicity in the region. And that like colonization has played a big part of like how we construct those things within our society, and that to this day is still a huge part of the social fabric that makes up our country and our nation and how we manage things there. So yeah,
Just something that came to mind when you're talking about this was, I don't know if you guys saw this recently, but I believe it is an indigenous woman in Vancouver caught, she abused as an Asian person because I guess she looked Asian, for lack of a better word, right? So again, the idea, the process of racialization is again, not a scientific, it never was a scientific process, right? And the way we view each other through outward, these outward supposed characteristics, which mark us out, I don't know the value in that. Obviously, this is not a unique opinion of mine. It's like backed up by everything in the world. But the fact that an Indigenous person can get mistaken for an Asian person because of the history of racialization and history of it being used to divide people up, it just goes to show that, you know, it doesn't, it's only skin deep in many, many multiple ways.
Are you energetic, mature, and committed to making a difference in the life of an Indigenous youth? Then you'd make a great mentor. Volunteer mentors at Vancouver's Urban Native Youth Association help youth recognize their many strengths and words towards future goals. To learn more about how you can become a mentor to a deserving young person, please visit unya.bc.ca/mentorship.
Welcome back. You're listening to Motherlands, the 2020 Asian Heritage Month programming at CITR 101.9 FM. Today's show has been made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. If you're just tuning in, today's show began with an interview with Rachel Lau, followed by a conversation between me and fellow Motherlands producers Zee Winter, Akshay Kulkarni, Joshua Azizi, and Adeline Pang. As I've mentioned, this is the last Tuesday in Asian Heritage Month, and thus the last episode of Motherlands. And as this experience draws to a close, I've been wanting to have some really honest and upfront conversations about Asian Heritage Month itself. In this discussion you just heard, myself and a few other Motherlands producers reflected on our feelings about making content for CITR this month, and more broadly what it's like to be included in a Pan-Asian category. I wanted to have a similar conversation with my supervisor, Alex DeBoer. Alex has been my editor on this series and works in a position of leadership at CITR as a spoken word coordinator. She's also white, and so is a lot of the leadership at CITR. In this final conversation, we talk about my conflicting feelings about taking on this position. So let's take a listen.
So thank you for joining me, Isa. So my name is Alex DeBoer, and I'm the spoken word coordinator / podcast coordinator at CITR, and I have been sort of overseeing Asian Heritage Month, providing edits and feedback to you and the other producers. This convo is sort of a kind of reflection, meant to be kind of a reflection and a time for kind of open and transparent feedback, I think, from you about your experience. So can you tell me, you were hired a couple months ago as this part-time kind of contract worker, and your title is Asian Heritage Month Special Programming Coordinator. So how did it feel for you when you were hired for this position?
Yeah, I was excited on one hand for sure, because I only had joined CITR in September of 2019. So this was a really good opportunity for me to get more experience in radio. And also I am interested in non-fiction storytelling. So again, this really aligned with my interests. But on the other hand, I was a bit worried about like tokenism. I didn't want to be pigeonholing myself. I don't want to be known as the person who exclusively makes Asian heritage content. I definitely, because I just, my concern was if I started building a portfolio solely about this sort of thing, like this would continue to be the only kind of work that I would be able to get. So I definitely had some reservations and concerns. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And we did talk about those, but I wonder if you could say what might have made you less concerned about being tokenized. Like, is there something at the station that could have been done, or is there a problem within the organization that you see and would recommend changing?
I think this is something that, like, everyone who's criticized CATR has brought up, is that the working employees there, the vast majority, I think, are white people. And CATR, from what I understand, a lot of the programming is volunteer run. And so you have a lot of people putting in a lot of time and energy into something they love and they would do regardless of whether or not they get paid. But a lot of these people who are not getting paid are like people of color or gender minorities or like whatever. And so it doesn't look the best. And again, like, it's better that you paid me than you didn't. I think you would have gotten a lot more flack if you guys decided to take me on to do this project and not pay me. So full disclosure, I am being paid for this. But also at the same time, I wonder if there are ways, and I understand there's a lot of things that come into play. Like, this is a nonprofit. There are budgeting constraints and whatnot, but there are, like, people shouldn't only be getting paid when they're making content that is relevant to diversity or promoting an idea of multiculturalism, like, to have, like, these quote-unquote discussions about these experiences. It makes the station seems like woke, for lack of better words, which is a good first step, but it doesn't really do justice to everyone else who's putting in work. And also, this is something we've also talked about, but it's more difficult, I personally think, for people of color or people who are identified as like women or like gender minorities or like minorities in general to inhabit these spaces. Even though we like to believe that CITR is very diverse and like art spaces are, or indie art spaces are like really woke, that's not always the case. And even when I first joined CITR, there were times where I felt like I didn't really fit in, and that was a concern.
Because you felt the space was too white?
Partially, yeah. So the people who were working and getting paid there were white. And so these were the people who really had that creative power and also like just power in general, I guess, in how things are run.
And you're talking primarily like your interactions working with like me and like Madeline, the programming manager, like Dora, the volunteer manager, Anna Rose, the station manager, and we're all white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. And we make up a lot of the creative energy of that space. Or rather, not so much the energy, but like we oversee it. So it's like we have power.
Yeah. I mean, I think most of the white employees have been pretty respectful and like thoughtful. Like, I know you've been very supportive in me talking about this sort of thing. So like, this is my, like, disclaimer, not all whites or whatever. But definitely there are moments where, like, a white person just isn't going to get it. Even when it comes to storytelling, like, when we... Something that really struck me, and this is, like, nothing personal, but when we were doing my piece on my granddad's home, I approached it from the point of view, like, telling, like, an atmospheric kind of memory. And your approach, which I really appreciate you taking a look at my notes at all, like, that really helped me strengthen and make the piece better. But one of your suggestions was that I kind of tie it into something greater. And so for a while, we toyed with the idea of me tying that into internalized racism, which is a very important conversation to be had, but also not always a conversation that you can have at any point, like, just right off the bat. Like, you have to, it's not an easy conversation, and it's not a conversation that you're always in the mood for, is what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I maybe didn't get the weight of that and, like, suggested it too readily based on what I thought I heard from you.
Yeah, like, I think narratively it probably would have made for a better story. But also, like, that was not the story I was trying to tell. And so this is something that came up in our panel discussion, is how there is a certain kind of performativity to Asian Heritage Month. And that, like, I'm not the only one who feels that. Other producers have reflected that as well.
Yeah, it's... It does also leave the question, though, like, how do you celebrate something and not, like, not have it be tokenizing? I mean, we have things like Asian Heritage Month or Black History Month or International Women's Day or whatever, Accessibility Day. Like, we have all these things, and we want to celebrate people and focus on certain groups to give them space at certain times. But it's hard to do that. Like, there's a fine line between doing that because you feel passionate about it and it's important, and doing it because you have to do it. Like, oh, it's this month, like, we should be doing this programming, you know? And I think that CATR is, like, really... also, like, overstretched. Like, the employees are, like, incredibly underpaid, and, like, we're trying to do all these things at once, and, like, the cost of that sometimes is that, like, we are tokenizing people, you know, because we're just trying to do what's right, but, like, it's ultimately sometimes more harmful.
Yeah, like, this isn't, any criticisms that I have isn't specific to CITR. Like, it's something that you see with a lot of quote-unquote, like, multicultural, woke spaces. It is, like, pretty common, so it's not, like, a specific attack on CITR. Again, I hope y'all hire me again. I definitely like it there. We'll continue volunteering there regardless. But please hire me.
Thank you for sharing those thoughts with me and reflecting on your experience. I think that I would just like to say that you've done an incredible job, and you're a very, very impressive person. And yeah, I appreciate your feedback. I think we all do at CITR, as we look to the future and how we can be diverse in a meaningful way. And not in a tokenizing way. So, thanks.
I just noticed that halfway, I don't know when, but she stopped recording, so I don't know how much of this is on tape.
Your Zoom?
Yeah.
She stopped recording, yeah. Okay, well, I don't know, dude.
This is Motherlands on CITR 101.9 FM, an Asian Heritage Month special programming initiative. I'm your host, Isa Yu, and you just heard Alex DeBoer interview me. It's time for this week's content recommendations. As I mentioned, today is the last episode, and there's so much good content to consume out there. I'll inevitably miss some really great things. So I guess this is your reminder to put your money where your mouth is and pay Asian artists slash spend money on consuming their content. In the last 3 days, I watched Hero and Moonlit Winter. Both are really good films I would recommend. Hero is a story about the attempted assassination of the Qing Emperor. Moonlit Winter is a movie about a lesbian couple that were split up when they were young but reunited 20 years later. Give both of them a watch. So thank you very much for listening to Motherlands on CITR 101.9 FM. Again, this week's theme was What Comes Next. I'm your host, Isa, and the other voices you hear belong to Rachel Lau, Ziwan To, Akshay Kulkarni, Adeline Peng, Alex DeBoer, and Joshua Azizi. The music you heard throughout today's show is from Blue Dot Sessions. As always, Motherlands is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. If you like this episode or any of the previous episodes, you can find it on iTunes or CITR.ca. This has been a really fun project, and I appreciated this chance to learn about the heritage of some of my peers, despite my reservations about taking on this job initially. I'm your host, Isa Yu, signing off. Thanks for listening. Stay safe out there.